Hey everyone, welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm Jeremiah Garcia, your host from Guide Dogs of Hawaii. This is a safe space for blind and visually impaired individuals to come together, share experiences, and learn from each other. Today, our guest is a retired community college counselor. She grew up in Louisiana, where she began her college experience at Louisiana Tech University. Here, she achieved a double major bachelor degree in Spanish and psychology. She launched a career at El Paso Community College in El Paso, Texas. While working full-time, she attended New Mexico State University, where she achieved her doctorate in counseling and educational psychology. After 15 years with El Paso Community College, she joined Windward Community College faculty as a counselor and disability specialist. After 10 years, she is retired. In addition to holding down a full-time career and advancing her education, she raised two children and volunteered in many causes, including National Federation of the Blind, Disability Rights Center, and Hawaii Center for Independent Living. I want to welcome Ann Lemke to Connect the Dots and start off by asking, what inspired you to become a college counselor?
Well, at the time that I was job hunting, when I finished my master's degree, I would have taken any reasonable job in either rehabilitation counseling, mental health counseling, college counseling, were the three areas that I was really looking at. And what inspired me when I began to realize that there was a field of college counseling was that I had never had much service from any kind of college counselor. And I wanted to be able to give other people things that I really hadn't received myself.
Selecting college counseling over the other counseling options was based on your own experience as a college student and the desire to make their way through college education easier. This must have been a strong motivator.
Yes, when I decided to go for my doctorate in counseling psychology, I had to study other areas, and it really doesn't make sense to study other areas unless you would be willing to change into one of those areas if the right opportunity came along. But what I found was that nothing really appealed to me as much as college counseling, except for the area of doing supervision of interns. That was a skill I developed in my getting my doctorate that I did pursue throughout the rest of my career.
As I understand it, a master's degree is generally required for a college counseling position. I can also understand expanding training to work with interns being interesting. I'm curious to know what motivated you to work towards a doctorate degree in psychology. Was this necessary for your specific line of work?
You know, I didn't need a doctorate. And it took me a long time to want to go back to school, to tell you the truth. But what I found in the course of my career as a college counselor was that sometimes I would make recommendations to students, to other professionals, that they would think, well, how can she say that? She's not a psychologist, or she doesn't have an advanced degree. And I begin to realize that for people to accept some of my ways of doing things, my recommendations, I needed that doctorate to kind of back me up, to say, yes, I do have the credentials and I have the experience and the ability to be saying what I'm saying.
Now that you completed your academic studies, training, career skills building, and launched your career at El Paso Community College, I imagine that although having completed all the formal education, you must have made new discoveries that prompted further training. Could you share something that comes to mind?
Well, I worked at two different colleges in my career. First was El Paso Community College in El Paso, Texas, which was primarily a Hispanic-serving institution and on the U.S.-Mexico border. And then I worked at Windward Community College for, I suppose, the last third of my career. I was thinking back to my very first day as a counselor in El Paso, Texas, January of 1977, which was during registration for the spring semester. And what I realized right away was that just about every student who had been in the college for at least a semester knew more about it than I did. It was very humbling, and I had to really develop the skill of listening and asking the right questions and building people's confidence in me that yeah, I was new and there were things I didn't know, but that didn't mean that I wasn't the person to help them. Now, you contrast that to my first day in Hawaii on the job. It was very different. I was hired because I was good in my field already, or they thought that I was, based on my resume and my the several interviews that I had with them. But they also offered me a mentor. And at first I said, well, I don't need a mentor. I understand college counseling. And my boss patiently, I have to say, said, well, you do understand college counseling. There's no doubt about that. But you don't know anything about Hawaii. So please work with somebody who can guide you to make culturally appropriate choices and recommendations and in-service training and the things that will help you be a better professional here.
Having good listening skills and learning what questions to ask must have been a daily practice for you when engaging with your students. Is there another useful skill or even characteristic that you use to help your students gain confidence in you as a counselor?
Another thing that goes along with that, although you don't want to do this overly much, you want to do it sparingly, but admit when you don't know something. In my case, because as my career went along and I would have to do things on the computer, and sometimes it takes me longer to do things, I would have to tell the student, I don't know the answer to your question right now. I would like to have an opportunity to research this, and we can get back together either in person or I can call you, or I can email you the information, or I can leave you a phone message, because I want to be sure I'm giving you the right information. Now, a sighted person could just click on the website, glance through it, but I couldn't always and can't always do it that quickly. And so it's better to be upfront and just say, it's going to take me a bit longer. I don't want you to have to sit here while I'm doing this. So give me an opportunity. And that's why I always liked that my appointments were scheduled. Well, so were everyone else's. That wasn't an accommodation for my disability. Most of us preferred having scheduled appointments so that we could review our notes if we had seen that student before, or just anything that we might know about what they wanted, we could be prepared.
Going back to your time pursuing your career in education, how did you manage financially to complete your higher education and achieve your degrees?
Going to college, for my first, in Louisiana, I'm originally from Louisiana, so my undergraduate degree was from Louisiana Tech, and I'm a Terry Bradshaw, by the way. At that time, the vocational rehab people paid for most of my college expenses. My parents paid some of my dorm and, you know, my room and board. And for graduate school, I had a stipend, a rehab services administration scholarship to study rehab counseling. And in my doctoral program, I didn't have any financial support, but my college that I was working for in El Paso did reimburse me when I would finish a semester. If I passed the courses, then they would reimburse what I spent, and they gave me the time off when I needed it to do my internship, my doctoral internship. So in a way, I had support of one way or another. I never took out any student loans. I saved money, or I decided, well, I don't want to go to a place that's that expensive. So I guess I'm a little unusual in that sense. And but I really think that that is the thing that people should research the most if they're going to college, is how they're going to pay for it. And yes, there's a lot of financial aid out there, and there are scholarships, and there is help from vocational rehabilitation. But more and more colleges themselves in the rehabilitation community also are saying, you can't change your mind 3 or 4 or 5 times. You need to know what you want to do. So the days of, well, I'll major in this, and if I don't like it, I'll do this other thing, and then maybe after that, I'll do this other thing. It's a lot tougher to be that person. You have to be a lot more focused and know yourself a lot better, because you're not going to get too many second and third chances.
For our listeners, the Terry Bradshaw that Ann references here is the former quarterback for the Pittsburgh Steelers. For NFL sports fans, Bradshaw helped the Steelers win 4 NFL championship games back in the late 1970s to early 80s. Don't confuse this Bradshaw, born in Louisiana, with the other Bradshaw in baseball. I would like to circle back to when you launched your career again. Having the educational credentials certainly was your key that launched your career. Can you reflect back to your first days on the job and tell us what it was like for you?
Yes, I felt insecure. I felt almost what they call it now, imposter syndrome, where you think, would they have really hired me? And what I thought at the time, that I would always do what I needed to do my best, because it was so hard to get my first job. So many rejection letters. I'm pretty sure that what helped me in getting my first job, well, I did have good interview skills, but I could speak Spanish, and which was a needed skill where I was. But you, at first, especially if it has taken you a lot of struggle to get that job, it's very normal to feel insecure and like you don't want to ask for much help. But if you don't ask for help, maybe you're going to make more mistakes than you need to make. So it's hard at first. You know, you really, really have to have that, to establish that balance between being assertive and independent but also knowing that you're growing as a professional and there is a lot you need to learn.
I'm sure that many of our listeners must be thinking of how hard the journey to becoming a college counselor would be. Could you share your thoughts on this?
Oh, sure. Everything is always harder than people think it's going to be. I think that that's true for everybody, and we wouldn't take on really hard things in life if we truly knew how hard it was going to be. You know, that person that wants to be the Olympic athlete, they may know right before the Olympics how hard it's going to be, but they didn't know when they were that young boy or girl dreaming big. They just knew they had a big dream and they wanted to follow it. So it's good that we don't always know how hard things are going to be. But at the same time, we need to be realistic and say, well, we can't do everything in life that we might want to do. So what are those things we're willing to work really hard to do?
Working hard to succeed at something you want to do is certainly not new to you. You demonstrated this when you changed your place of employment from El Paso Community College to Windward Community College. What I find interesting is that you didn't change jobs in the same town, let alone the same state. You moved jobs and home. This would be something scary for many. How did you manage this so successfully?
Well, first of all, I didn't move here until I had the job offer.
Oh, okay.
So that was different. And I had a number of conversations with my future boss after I was offered the job. Things that he would tell me that he wished other people had known when they came to Hawaii to take jobs. And I talked to as many people as I could, blind people who knew other blind people in Hawaii, so I contacted people in the National Federation of the Blind in Hawaii and said, well, you know, moving here. I also contacted Ho'opono, and one of the person who was my counselor when I, because I said I may need some equipment and the college is going to provide me some things, but I may need more than they're providing. And so they collaborated very well, the college in Ho'opono. And but just trying to start that network of people before I ever moved here. And so that's what I would say. You know, you, especially if you know the situation you're coming into is going to be very different in some aspects, don't wait until you move to start figuring it out. I even did things like on the Newsline program for the National Federation for the Blind, where you can read newspapers. I subscribed to whatever the paper was at that time. It wasn't the Star Advertiser, but and I subscribed to some podcasts about Hawaii, and you know, I did everything I could. I talked to people that knew people. I just feel like that kind of thing is very important.
Getting as much information and establishing some form of network that you can turn to as you settle into your new home and work environments does save a lot of unnecessary stress and frustration. It is a sensible thing to do. What about mobility? You have a guide dog, and I imagine it must have been quite a transition for the both of you to adjust to a totally new place.
Oh, yes. Because when I came here, I had a guide dog, but of course my dog had never been here before. So I asked people at work, can you show me how to get from this place to this place? I think Ho'oponopono might have provided me a little bit of mobility training at first. And certainly guide dogs of Hawaii have provided me some mobility training here on Kauai after I got my dog, which I've had for a couple of months, my newest dog, and getting used to where I live right now. And then I'm going to be turning around and moving. But I didn't know that when I came back with my dog. I just recently have had an opportunity to move back to Oahu. And let's see, what did the godfather, what did they say in the Godfather? It's an offer too good to refuse.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not sinister. I mean, a friend had an apartment available in Kaneohe that just would be perfect for me. So, and I miss my friends. I wanna be back where I know people.
It looks like you've been working with a guide dog for years, making you a forever guide dog handler. What inspired you to work with a guide dog?
Yes. When I was getting my master's degree at Texas Tech, which was back in the 70s, I had a friend who was a blind student on campus there, and she had a dog, and we would go places off campus to restaurants or stores or wherever, and she could just get around so easily, and I could get around okay, and I would struggle to keep up with her because she was walking with the dog, and I thought, I want that kind of freedom and that kind of sense of not being tied down to using a cane. And so I began to ask around. And one of the mobility instructors that I had at a rehab center in Austin told me about the Leader Dog program in Michigan. And so I applied and went there. And that's how I started. I still get my dogs from there after 45 years.
You obviously achieved mobility freedom with your first guide dog because you continue to work with the dogs for 45 years. It's said that guide dogs are really expensive, so it would be great if you could share how you financially cared for your dogs, making it possible to enjoy the mobility freedom you have.
It's not that most of the schools don't charge the students for transportation or the training, but then keeping the dog, the dog is not a pet. You want that dog to be in the best health, to have the best food, to have the best grooming, all of that, because you're on display in a way, whether you mean to be or not, but when you're in the public, whether you're walking in the neighborhood or going to a restaurant, going to a store, going to a doctor's appointment, it doesn't matter. People are going to judge the use of guide dogs. So you have to be on top of it, and your dog has to be that dog that other people would want to have around. Here, guide dogs helps me. They have some choices that they give you about ways that they can be supportive, and I chose to request vet support for vet visits because I figured, well, any dog a person might have, you're going to buy food. And then I have an advantage that other people don't have as far as animal grooming. I can, because Windward Community College has a veterinary assisting training program, and I'm a retired faculty member, so I can, my dog can receive grooming, nails trim, and all of that, bath, and there from, you know, every couple of months. So yes, guide dogs of Hawaii are very generously providing me support with vet visits.
It is good to know from an experienced handler that maintaining a guide dog is doable. The training and the dog itself are free. What the handler financially takes care of is the day-to-day care of the dog, which is food, veterinary care, and grooming. I think it is helpful to know that there are resources out there that are available to help with these costs. Guide dogs are remarkable working dogs, guiding you to and from work, but don't do everything. What assistive technology have you used?
The technology I had was a reel-to-reel tape recorder and a cassette recorder, a four-track cassette recorder, so that you could get more information on the cassette tape. I used a device which I had not heard of, but some of the other blind students at Louisiana Tech knew about, called a steno mask, like a stenographer's mask, where you would talk in it. You attached it to your tape recorder by a cable, and you would speak into the mask. It was kind of soundproofed, and you would push a lever so it would record or not record, depending on when you needed it to be recording. And then after class, I would go back to my room and listen to the notes I had recorded, which wasn't that much, maybe 10 minutes or whatever for a whole class. And usually I would re-speak the notes onto another tape so I could add information or rephrase information. I had very, very good notes, but they started out as dictated notes into my mask, to a steno mask. And so that was my first technology that I hadn't known anything about in high school. And then let's fast forward to the 80s. I'm in El Paso. It's 1987 or 88, not sure, I think. Everyone's starting to use those personal computers, but I had no clue how to use it. But I had a friend in El Paso who was blind, and her husband was blind at that time, was blind, and they used computers. And so I asked my employer, I said, if I were to take every Friday afternoon off, and went home, and I pay the person to train me myself, but you all just give me the time off, but I pay them myself. Could I do that so I can learn to use the computer as a blind person? And then I'll need to tell you what technology it is that I'll need to make the computer work. At that time, synthesizer in the program. So that's what I did for several months. She would come every Friday afternoon, and we would work for, she would give me homework. But that's how I learned to use a computer. I didn't wait for my boss to say, you know, you're falling behind everybody else because you're not using the computer. I didn't do that. I proactively looked for ways that I could learn to use it.
Your proactive attitude, especially at a time when technology was limited, in addition to your commitment to work hard towards your goal, is especially present during these early days of technology for the blind. Just taking notes advanced for you from cassette recordings to computer word processing software. That must have been quite an evolutionary time for technology.
Yes, but boy, it really changed after the computer. Things, you know, especially when I moved to Hawaii, the software that we would use to access student grades, student test reports, and our own notes, all of that, they would evolve it. Just when I thought I knew it, then they would make changes. And that wasn't just frustrating for me. It was frustrating for the sighted people, too, I'm glad to say. I know that sounds mean, but I didn't want to be the only one who had a hard time. And as I understand it, it still continues to evolve. They want as much to be automated as possible and as much to be online. And sometimes I just had to ask for help. I would have to ask for help accessing a particular database that that wasn't accessible. But there were programs that extracted information from that database that were accessible. So it's just a lot of workarounds that I had to use, sometimes having to ask for help. What I've always did do in my career to kind of help people realize that I had a lot of value for the organization, I would offer to do things that I knew other people didn't want to do as much as I did. So in El Paso, I would often help with problem student situations during registration, where other people were helping people in the gym or in other, you know, doing locations that were away from the office. I would be the one that people had to go see to figure out what they were going to ask the dean to let them back into school, you know, if they hadn't done well the previous semester, to help them work up a plan to how they would improve. I would do that kind of thing. It was a service that someone needed to do. Everybody didn't want to do it. I was good at it. And it helped me avoid people saying, she doesn't do her share of the work. And when I moved here, one of the things that I like to do that a lot of people did not like to do, I like to work with students who wanted to take classes in college while they were still in high school. Now it's all the rage, but it hasn't always been that way. A lot of people used to think, well, it's watering down our classes if we let high school students take them. They can't be that hard. But I had actually several students in Kaneohe at Windward who graduated from high school at the same time that they graduated from community college, because they had been taking classes while they were in high school. And I'm glad to say I was a little part of that process by believing in them and helping them know what they needed to do.
I like that you pointed out the importance of being a team player, in that you found ways to fully contribute to the college team of professionals by identifying what you were good at and matching it up with the task. You just shared valuable information for our high school listeners about the opportunity to enroll in community college courses while still attending high school. Hey, high school listeners, reach out to your school counselor for more information if you are interested in doing something like this. Nowadays, people seeking employment look at what benefits are offered. Can you share what benefits may be offered at a community college?
Well, the big thing that people can expect is, of course, your health insurance, your and vacation pay, sick leave. Now, in certain jobs, such as the ones I had, they didn't want you to take your vacation leave in the middle of registration or sometime when it was super, super busy. And we needed to respect that. But it was good to know that you could plan ahead and have and know when you were going to have time off. And another benefit for certain kinds of jobs, and I think this goes for counseling, people in the healthcare industry, people who are attorneys, even some people in the financial sector, is in-service training. A lot of jobs require people to update their skills, but it's a good chance to network with other professionals. Sometimes it's a good chance to travel, to go to another state, another area, another community. One of the benefits that I had when I became a tenure, when I earned tenure in both El Paso and Hawaii, was to be able to be on committees where we looked at whether other people who were coming along as professionals should also earn tenure. That was a big responsibility. But I would say mainly the benefit is the paid benefits, such as vacation leave, sick leave, sometimes benefits like a retirement plan or choices of what kind of retirement plan to have. And training, the benefit of being able to get training, additional training.
The opportunity for continued professional development training is a big bonus, I would think. Add travel and new network contacts can only be fun and interesting. This, on top of the standard employee benefits, is a generous package. To enjoy all these benefits, can you give us an example of a typical day at work?
Well, I'll just say at Windward, I would have blocks of time that appointments could be scheduled. And we could decide how much time we needed for our appointments. Some people chose a half hour for their student appointments. I always chose 45 minutes. I just felt like a half hour was rushing students too much. And we could choose when we began. So my first appointment was always at 9:15, or could be that early. I didn't always have a 9:15 appointment. And then my last appointment could be as late as, sometimes I had 4:15 appointments, usually 3:30 was the latest, but so I could have appointments all day, but excluding lunch hour, excluding scheduled meetings. But between appointments or before they began for the day, I would review what I needed to. Sometimes it might mean reviewing the students' history of how they were doing in school. Sometimes it would mean reviewing my notes. What had I offered to assist a student with? What did the student committed to do? Sometimes it would mean talking to one of my colleagues that that might have had that student as a student. Always I had to make time to do my notes, because if I waited too long, I wouldn't remember what I was going to say about the meeting. And try to keep it fairly generic, because I know that I would know that someone else might have access to that information, my boss or another counselor. But I would try to put information objectively and not too much of my opinion. I don't think this student is going to follow through would be something I would never put in writing. I might say in writing, I encourage the student to see me at least once a month so we can discuss progress. That's a lot more positive way of dealing with that concern that the student might not follow through. So, yeah, generally, I did better. I didn't like a lot of downtime because if I would go on the computer to research something, and 45 minutes later, oh my gosh, what time is it? Having a schedule kept me focused.
You shared the importance of having honest and humbling relationships with your students and the value to working hard towards your goal while keeping a proactive attitude. You also touched on the importance of being a team player among your colleagues. What I am interested in hearing now is how you manage collaboration and networking with your colleagues and other professionals connected with your profession.
Well, it's good at first to talk to people in their own space, in their office or in a common area, cafeteria, wherever, but to establish communication with people where they can speak freely. And when you're in a meeting and there are other people present, try not to have to disagree in front of other people, unless that other person leaves you no other choice and you must disagree. And even then, do it respectfully. But so I would say, always when you're networking, yes, I would ask people, how's your mom doing? How'd your son's basketball game go? How'd your daughter's swim meet go? Whatever. But I wasn't there just to chit-chat. I would try to make most interactions somewhat work focused.
Reflecting back in all your years as a college counselor, what would you say was your favorite and most challenging part of your career?
My favorite part was helping people do things that they didn't think they could do, or helping people understand their choices and understand that that they can make decisions for themselves. I wasn't going to make decisions for them, but I could help them be more empowered people. That was my favorite part of my job. And of course, I've always liked working with, whether it's a student, whether it's a coworker, whether it's another professional in the community. I always like working with people who could do something better than I could do it, or had skills that I maybe didn't have. The worst part of my job was when I felt that too pressured, too much going on and not enough time to get it done. And having to decide, well, what am I going to not do all of? Because I can't leave this line of students all waiting. So how am I going to keep this appointment to 15 minutes or 10 minutes? And so I can see everybody. And I'm remembering a day. It was about probably 5 years ago when I was still working, that I ended up, it was during late registration for college, and I ended up seeing about 20 students that day, where the most I would normally ever see was 8. And I just knew at the end of that day, I'm not feeling well. This is not going well for me. So yeah, too much pressure.
Were there any other areas of the organization that you can get involved with aside from your day-to-day responsibilities?
There were several kinds of job responsibilities we had as a tenured professional. We were supposed to, of course, put our job first, our duties in the job description, and then service to the college. That might be committees and or volunteering for helping with an activity. And then community service, which was one of my favorite parts of the job, was representing the college, or in some cases representing myself as a professional in the community with organizations. And then finally, the fourth area was professional development. And sometimes we could use time for that. I would ask whoever my boss was, supervisor, hey, I don't have any appointments Friday afternoon, and so-and-so is doing a tour of some Lo'i, or some Heiau, or some other sites that I felt like would increase my knowledge of Hawaiian culture. So, yeah, as long as I kept the priorities in order, in proper ratio or whatever, I had a certain amount of freedom to do things that I wanted to do.
Now that you are retired, what have you been doing or plan to do?
Not enough volunteer work because of the pandemic. I envisioned retirement being where I would find a volunteer, some volunteer work to do, and then do it. Well, I've done a lot of legislative volunteer work with the National Federation of the Blind here in Hawaii. I've done some. I'm also a volunteer. Well, I'm a member of the Hawaii Disability Rights Center Board of Directors, and so I've had various volunteer positions. I've found a lot of training opportunities on Zoom because of the pandemic, and even some of those still continue. I also had to develop, when I wanted to get the dog that I have now, I needed to produce some videos showing that I had good cane travel skills before I could be approved to get a new dog. And then after they approved my application to get a dog, but before I went, I felt like I needed to walk every day to keep my skills up, you know, my travel skills current. So I generally walk about an hour a day. And I still do that, and I could still plan to do that. And so when I get to Oahu, I plan to talk to the people at the AARP, the retired people organization, to see what kind of volunteer opportunities they might know about. And I'll do something a couple times a week, maybe. It might just be answering phones. It might be making phone calls. It might be participating in some kind of meetings or groups. But I definitely believe that volunteer work is important.
You have achieved so much. Higher education in your career choice, moved home and job to a different state, obtained your doctorate, volunteered in various groups, and overcame technology challenges. You have done all this with determination and a positive attitude, pocketing so much knowledge and experiences. What would you say to any of our listeners that are interested in becoming a college counselor?
I would say try to at the college you might be going to, see if you can have a paid position with their services for students with disabilities or the counseling office. And meet as many college counselors as you can and talk with them, and as many college counselors with disabilities as you can. And but definitely try to get a practicum or internship in doing the kind of work you'd like to do.
This has been a deep conversation, and I would like to close with a fun and light question. In three words, describe yourself as a child and as the adult you are today.
Kind of a troublemaker. I always knew when things weren't fair, and I was always ready to challenge that. But at the same time, I was shy. So sometimes I would really have to rehearse what I wanted to say in a situation. I was adventurous. I loved new experiences as a child, and okay, so some of that carries over to me as an adult. Now I would describe myself as generally content. I feel that I'm doing the best I can generally in my circumstances with the resources that I have. I try to be so content would be one word. I'm still adventurous. I still like new experiences. And I still don't like it when things aren't fair. And the only difference maybe between now and when I was a child is that I realized that it's not all about me, that there are many, many, many people in this world for whom life isn't fair and who need our kokua. They need our understanding, our help, and sometimes our forgiveness as we would ask them to forgive us sometimes when we haven't been very helpful or understanding.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Anne. You have given our listeners in-depth information about being a college counselor. It was a great pleasure talking with you today.
Well, it was a pleasure being here.
As we draw to a close with this episode, I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you enjoyed your visit and found useful information. We welcome your feedback at feedback@guidedogsofhawaii.org. It would be great if you would visit us on our social media platforms, such as Instagram and Facebook. You can find us by simply searching for Guide Dogs of Hawaii.